Watch your DVR Nevada Newsmakers Saturday and Sunday mornings from 5:30 to 6:30 on Cox Cable Channel 12 or Dish and Direct TV Channel 21 or anytime at NevadaNewsmakers.com.
I'm Jeff Gehrman, an investigative reporter with the Las Vegas Review-Journal. I'm your guide for season two of Mobbed Up, The Fight for Las Vegas.
You're in with every gangster and hoodlum in the United States.
I don't go for that, Mr. Kennedy. I don't go for that kind of action.
I was on television accused of fronting for the mob.
Subscribe to Mobbed Up, The Fight for Las Vegas, Season 2, today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It is definitely an insurgency, although I would say it's more like a government in exile, because I was waiting for something like this to happen the moment that the elections were won.
From the Las Vegas Review-Journal, this is RJ Politics.
Hello and welcome to RJ Politics, the Las Vegas Review-Journal's weekly political podcast. I'm politics reporter Rory Appleton.
And I'm politics and government editor Steve Sebelius.
So we're back after an extra week break or so, because it has been very, very busy, which we'll now start recapping now. The governor signed a flurry of bills from the legislative session, many of them with live events, many of which I was at. So we'll talk about that a little bit too. But first, we want to talk about something that happened the previous week. There was a split that we've talked about, you know, coming for a while now. It formally sort of happened, and essentially it breaks down like this. So in the Nevada State Democratic Party, we've obviously talked about quite a bit, they had new leadership elected earlier this year. Is a very, very progressive slate. It was a slate that was, you know, not necessarily the first choice of many of Nevada's elected officials, including Senator Catherine Cortez Masto. So since then, there have been rumors that the ex-staff would find some other way to sort of run the coordinated campaign without the state party. And that's exactly what happened. They announced that the coordinated campaign, the campaign for Governor Steve Sisolak, for Cortez Masto, this campaign that is essentially usually run by the state party as an effort to get all sort of voters out in favor of the entire Democratic ticket, will now be ran out of the Washoe County Democratic Party and not the Nevada State Democratic Party. As expected, the leaders were sort of like, oh, yeah, no, this isn't a sign of disunity or anything like that. You know, this is just the choice we made and everything like that. We former majority leader Harry Reid, you saw this too. You obviously wrote about this. Basically, was telling anybody who asked, nothing to see here. This split is all in the media and things like that. But it is definitely a major, major shift, and it was something that the Nevada State Democratic Party took very personally, very quickly. Within probably a few hours of it happening, the Nevada State Democratic Party put out a statement basically calling it an insurgency. It was an insurgency within our, I'm reading the exact statement here. Once again, we find ourselves disappointed but not surprised, but this time it's regarding an insurgency within our own party instead of in the Republican Party. So here's the sort of the split. It appears now this coordinated campaign has hired a staff. It is essentially the staff of the previous Nevada State Democratic Party. And the Nevada State Democratic Party has also hired its own staff, finally, as they've come around to that. So now you've got essentially dueling kind of organizations in Nevada with the same ultimate stated purpose of electing Democrats. Whether that's actually the case is something that is currently being argued behind closed doors, probably as we speak.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it is definitely an insurgency, although I would say it's more like a government in exile, because I was waiting for something like this to happen the moment that the elections were won by this new slate of people who were not the former Reid people who he had seeded the party with. After the 1998 election, the infamous election of 1998, Reid won by 421 votes. The close call. Reid gathered people after that and said, this can never happen again. We have to make sure that this is a thing of the past. The party at the time was run by some very well-meaning activists, old school FDR-style Democrats who were true believers and some great people in the party at the time, but not professional organizers, not professional field people. And so what Reed did when he brought in Rebecca Lamb was to start the process of sort of professionalizing this party and bringing in people who had worked in successful campaigns and creating this new network. And there's a number of people. I was thinking about it the other day as I was writing about this. The list of people, current and former, who have worked in the Nevada State Democratic Party during the 20 years that it has been almost universally successful in every election, is so long that it's really, really difficult to keep track of all those folks who have gone on to bigger and better things elsewhere, but who really transformed that party into what we know as the Reed machine now. And it was just an amazing transformation over the period of just a few years, from Reed almost losing his seat to Reed never, ever again having a very competitive election, to the President of the United States, Barack Obama, winning twice, Hillary Clinton winning, Joe Biden winning. You have Governor Sisolak winning, the first Democratic governor in 20 years. The control of the legislature has been in Democratic hands almost all of that time, 2014 being the one outlier year, the exception of all that. But the Reed machine battled back from that and took over every office. So that there's a natural tension, I think, between these two groups. You've got the professional operatives who the new people don't see as politically committed enough to electing progressives and pursuing a progressive agenda. And then you have the professionals who are scratching their heads to say, how can you argue with all this success? I don't understand how you can look at this organization that people built, that they put their blood, sweat, and tears into when they could have been doing other more lucrative things elsewhere. And built this organization that wins, and so there's that natural tension there. Although the people I talk to, still maintained to varying degrees, still maintained hope that there will be a role to play for the state party. Now they are not leaving the coordinated campaign in anybody's hands. They're taking no chances on that. And that is going to be run through the Washoe County Democratic Party. The fundraising will go there. The professional organizers will work there. There will be offices throughout the state of Nevada, but it'll be headquartered in the Washoe County Party. And so that's a done deal. But I think there's still hope that down the road that there can be some kind of way to bring the party, the state party in its current incarnation, back into that fold. And I think that's what Reed's comments were designed to do. He's sort of flattering the people that are in the party now to try to harness their energy, because Reed knows, and all these professionals around him know, politics is a game of addition, not subtraction. And so they say to themselves, The progressives are very committed. They're very their activism is obvious. They were able to take over the state party. That enthusiasm is something we should capture to help elect Democratic candidates. Now, there may not always be the Democratic candidates that the people in the party want, but at the end of the day, they're hoping that the party people realize that a moderate Democrat is better than a conservative Republican. And I don't know that that's always been the thinking among the progressives. And so that's still a hurdle that may have to yet to be overcome.
To me, that happened a few days after I wrote the story, which was on June 9th, I think it was, is you saw a statement from the Left Caucus, which is part of the State Democratic Party, and the Las Vegas Democratic Socialists of America. And these are two groups where Whitmer, the chair of the state party, she was previously chair of the Left Caucus. She's a member of both. These are the progressives that make up sort of her base in the party. They put out a statement that had a particular particular line in it that made me sort of perk up, which was, in the coming primary season, Democrats will remember who among our representatives stood for the choice of the people and who stood only for themselves. Basically, they were saying that by circumventing the state party, which elected its chair through a democratic process, they were essentially circumventing democracy. And now what was interesting to me is that, you know, the state central committee that elects the state leaders is made up of a couple hundred people. It was not necessarily a fully democratic election like, say, the one that chose the governor or the one that chose, you know, Senator Cortez Masto, these folks who received hundreds of thousands of votes. So that was kind of an interesting point to make, but it's essentially a threat. I took it as a political threat of a possible primary, you know, and I don't know who it would be. I don't know who in this group of leaders who signed on to this, including obviously the assembly speaker and the majority leader of the Senate. I don't know who it would be. I don't know what it would look like, but it definitely took it as a threat to me. So I both sides are kind of saying unity, but then you see the sort of broadsides from different parts of the party in this way. And that makes you think, maybe not so much unity.
Well, I can let the Left Caucus and the Democratic Socialists of America in on a little secret and solve their dilemma. The politicians will always stand with themselves, okay? Regardless of what they say, regardless of what they do, they are always going to stand with themselves. That's probably why you're not seeing any of these congressional candidates weighing in on any of these kind of things, because they want to harness the votes of the party members who voted in this new slate, and marry that to the party members at large. But they're always going to act in their self-interests, no matter what their true beliefs, whether they're an actual progressive or a moderate. They're going to want all those votes, and so they're going to say and do whatever it takes to convince all the folks that they're on their side. And so it's not really a hard calculation to make. But the pragmatic side of politics, I think, is oftentimes lost in this whole debate. It's the difference, as Bill Clinton famously said, you know, I'm not in the speech making business. I'm not in the philosophizing business. I'm in the winning business. You can't do anything if you don't win, and you have to win first. And then once you win, you got to win again, and you got to keep winning if you want to stay in office, if you want to do the things that you set out to do. Unfortunately, as those of us who live in the world of reality know, that often means you have to compromise. You can't go in and, enact the progressive agenda. If it were that easy, if you could push the Staples easy button and make it happen, it would have happened already. The fact that it hasn't happened is proof positive of the fact that governing requires compromise and consensus. And that is just a fact of life. And I know the progressives are frustrated by that. But guess what? So are the pragmatic professionals who built this party. And they are frustrated by the fact that, like, look, if we run everybody to the left, if we run the most progressive candidate in every single district, we will lose seats. It's just so simple. We will lose some seats. In certain seats, you have to have a moderate, pragmatic Democrat. I think of Susie Lee in this case. To a lesser extent, Stephen Horsford. You can't run Dina Titus in the 3rd Congressional District, although I will point out for the record that they did and she won. But that, I think, has more to do with Dina Titus's unique personality than it does the district and the registration and the demographics that are in that district. So these realities are going to have to come into play. And reality has a way of smacking you in the face really, really good when it comes down to the wire. We can wish the world to be a certain way, but it is not that way. And the way it really is eventually going to assert itself in these debates. And so it makes total sense to me that the coordinated campaign would move up to the Washoe County Party. That is it is a sign of disunity, but it's also a sign of, you know, a party that's desperate to maintain the wins that it has already won and to maintain the machinery that it has spent 20 years building, as well as to elect Democrats. And I think at the end of the day, I mean, if you were to ask the current slate of members of the Nevada State Democratic Party, who would you rather have as governor, Steve Sisolak or Adam Laxalt? I don't think any of them would hesitate for a moment to say Sisolak. Now, if you ask them, who would you rather have as governor? Would you rather have Steve Sisolak or maybe Amy Vilela? then I think most of them would probably say Amy Vilela as well. But that wasn't the choice. And that's never going to be the choice. And so, you know, these realities, I think they have to assert themselves eventually. And that's just going to be, part of this going forward, the resolving of this tension. And look, the people who have won all these races are really good at bringing a coalition together and putting everybody on the same page. And I think that they'll ultimately be successful as well. But like you say, if they don't get to that point, if they say, as some Bernie people did in 2016, well, we'd rather stay home than have Hillary, then the Democrats are in trouble.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is always fresh in these more establishment Democrats' mind. I think that they do need to keep all parts of the base energized at least enough to actually show up and vote, especially in an off year where you're seeing all kinds of prognostications of the Democrats losing their very thin Senate majority or any number of things. I mean, you know, Cortez Masto and, you know, Governor Sisolak, I mean, those are tough races. They had both of their first sort of initial elections were tough. I mean, you're talking about you win by 4 or 5 points. I mean, you killed it. I mean, you're doing really well. I mean, this is not a situation like sort of the Dina Titus first district where you're going to win by 20 points no matter what by virtue of being a Democrat. And so I think that's part of it. I also think particularly with those two, with Cortez Masto and the governor, I do think that this also gives them sort of a lane politically when it comes to tying them and all Democrats to socialism and to kind of like this, the progressive sort of movement, Medicare for all, those types of things. I think that we've seen that a major Republican tactic in all campaigns, national, local, every level, is to tie any Democrat to the most far left sort of policy or person, thinking of like a Congressman Ocasio-Cortez or something like that, who she is part of all these campaigns of people who she's probably never even met, just because of that's the Republican tactic. So I think that this does, you know, they're going to want some unity, they're going to want the support of progressives, but I do think that if for some reason, there was any sort of traction being gained in this, you know, Catherine Cortez Masto or Steve Sisolak's a socialist, which we've already seen in the governor's race where there are challengers and North Las Vegas Mayor John Lee has been all over that, beating that drum already. I left the Democratic Party because they're socialists and Sisolak is one of them. He's king socialist, you know, that type of thing. We've seen it already. I could see how there would be some traction in this and say, well, no, look, We're not part of them, and they don't much care for us actually either. Look at the statement that the DSA and the actual proper sort of socialists put out, kind of threatening me. I'm not like that. We have this coordinated campaign in Washoe because we believe in solutions and the middle ground. You know, we're a long way away from that. But I could definitely see that as being sort of like a possibility. And I've even heard, you know, from some Republican sources around here that is something that they're kind of looking at as they were jubilant over the discord in the Democratic Party to begin with. But this last time around, a little bit less so in terms of, you know, happily putting out statements condemning. There were no statements that I saw, and I asked for them, condemning, you know, putting dunking on this move by the Democrats or whatever. I think they're actually seeing that there's a possible kind of lane for Cortez Masto or the governor to take. But I think that's a long way away, and we'll be around definitely as people start taking those lanes. But we also wanted to get into for the last sort of half of the show here is the governor has done basically a big sort of media tour these last 2 weeks. I've been there. My wife's been there. We've had a couple different people out at most of these events in which he signed many of the sort of key bills that we've been talking about in the last couple of weeks, as expected, and did not veto anything totally unexpected. The main bills that I'm thinking of are the mining tax, which we knew he would sign. It was brokered, you know, in partnership with a lot of different groups, including the mining industry. That was a pretty much a given, the mining tax going straight to education. We also saw the public option bill, which again, he had said previously, he's definitely going to sign. But I also wanted to talk a bit about some of the election bills, because those ones I had asked previously his office, are you going to sign these? Are you going to sign them? And I never heard anything. And then last Friday, he did ultimately sign pretty much the whole slate of them, including AB 126, which is the big one we've talked about, which is the bill to now the law that would get us away from the presidential caucuses and into a presidential primary, move Nevada up on the nominating calendar. He also signed, you know, some of the other various bills that will make mail-in voting permanent. A lot of the changes you saw in COVID are now going to be permanent, essentially. And it also establishes like a counting process and, you know, a few other things. But that AB 126 is the really interesting one, because as we've talked about before, the parties are going to have a say in this. There's going to be a lot of sort of movement and discussion and talks about this over the next probably year or maybe even two, maybe up to the next regular session in 2023, before the 2024 election, to figure out exactly what the election, the presidential election, looks like in Nevada before 2024.
Watch your DVR Nevada Newsmakers Saturday and Sunday mornings from 5:30 to 6:30 on Cox Cable Channel 12 or Dish and Direct TV Channel 21 or anytime at NevadaNewsmakers.com.
I'm Jeff Gehrman, an investigative reporter with the Las Vegas Review-Journal. I'm your guide for season two of Mobbed Up, The Fight for Las Vegas.
You're in with every gangster and hooligan in the United States.
I don't go for that, Mr. Kennedy. I don't go for that kind of action.
I was on television accused of fronting for the mob.
Subscribe to Mobbed Up, The Fight for Las Vegas, season two, today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, and this is an interesting one, because it was bipartisan support for this bill, and I think there was universal support for moving away from the caucuses. I don't think either party liked the caucuses. I think the caucuses were bulky and clunky, and there were a lot of weird rules. People didn't like participating in them. There will surely be an increase in voter turnout when it's a presidential preference primary and you go to the polls and vote, or vote by mail, or vote early, however you want to do it, and do it in the traditional way. So that, I think, is settled. The universal switch to a primary, everybody likes that. But there were other elements to this and that weren't so popular across party lines. I should note that AB 126 was approved over the objections and the no votes of both leaders, James Settlemyer in the Senate, Dr. Robin Titus in the Assembly. But there were some other more moderate Republicans that joined with the Democrats to pass this. And it really is interesting, because it doesn't just switch us from a caucus system to a primary system. Basically, what it does is that rearranges how the parties in Nevada bind their delegates to the national convention. Before, at the caucus, you know, you caucus for the person that you wanted to go for, and if your person won, well, you stood a chance of becoming a delegate to the county, to the state, to the national convention. Not anymore. Now, this basically says that the party meetings can only take place after this election happens, which is going to be on the first Tuesday of February of the even numbered years. Only then the results of the primary election will bind the delegates. In other words, the people in the state of Nevada, the delegates to the national convention, will have to go by what the voters have said. And not just the voters who turn out at the party meetings or turned out to the caucus. We're talking the turnout, as I said, is going to be much greater. So this should be much more representative of what the broad swath of Republicans and Democrats in the state of Nevada believe about who should be their party's nominee. Minor parties are not going to be on this ballot. Only the major parties are going to be on this ballot. The only exception would be if a party only has one candidate. For example, in 2020, President Donald Trump was running essentially unopposed. There were a few minor candidates who tried to run against him, but they were all subsumed by his popularity. So if there was one candidate, then there would be no need to have a Republican on the presidential primary ballot in that example. Ditto if President Biden is running for re-election in 2024 and he has no competition, then he wouldn't appear on the ballot. It would only be for Republicans. So, but the results of these things bind those delegates to the national convention. And so that is going to be interesting to see what happens. There is some talk in Republican circles. They don't like the fact that Nevada has tried to essentially jump the calendar and be the first on the calendar. We've talked about it on this podcast before. You know, Iowa feels very strongly they should have the first caucus in the nation, even though they screwed theirs up in 2016 pretty badly. New Hampshire has a state law that says it must hold the first primary. Those things have to be worked out by the Democratic National Committee and also by the Republicans. And so you saw the chairman, they're all men, of the first four states, essentially put out a statement saying, no, we want to keep things the way they are in terms of the order. We want it to be Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina. And our chairman, Michael McDonald, signed on to that. Now, I don't think he signed on necessarily because he didn't want Nevada to be first. I think he signed on to that just because in past years, when other states tried to jump the calendar and go before us, those first four states all hung together and said, no, the order is going to be Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina. And out of a sense of loyalty, I think he signed on to this statement, knowing full well, though, that really this matter is not up to the Republican chairman of those four states. It's not up to the Republican parties in those four states. It's not even up to the Republican National Committee or the Democratic National Committee. Nevada now has a set date by law. Now, whether or not that will be the first, we'll see, because the other states can do some maneuvering, but it's really out of his hands. And so signing on to that was kind of an act of loyalty, knowing full well, though, that it really didn't matter, because there's nothing that can be done by any of those four states to keep the order the way it is if Nevada's law holds and the other states, you know, work out their differences. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how the other states now react now that Nevada has planted its flag on a specified date. My personal theory is that either this has all been worked out in advance by the wondrous and powerful Harry Reid behind the scenes, has already worked with the Democrats to strike a deal to say Nevada gets to go first, or Iowa will go in the middle of January and New Hampshire will go at the end of January, and then Nevada will come and the order will be maintained, and South Carolina will go shortly after us in early February as well. So we could see either one of those scenarios happening. There is yet a third scenario, and I know you want to talk about this, Roy, and that is that the Republicans just say, you know what, we're not going to participate. None of our candidates are going to file for the ballot, and we're just going to do it the traditional way to select our nominee at party meetings. That would be really interesting as well, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was something, because I did inquire to Republicans, you know, because you saw this sort of public statement, you know, we're going to keep the order as is. I guess it's not necessarily, I guess both could probably have their way. In the second scenario you mentioned, where Iowa and New Hampshire just move themselves up, then I guess the two situations can be satisfied in terms of the state law saying we're going to go second Tuesday in February, I think it is, what it specifically says in the new state law here in Nevada. We would satisfy that requirement, as well as the Republicans would get what they're asking for, which is essentially the same order. But what I was curious about is, you know, what happens if there's a scenario, because I think you're right. I think the Democrats, we've seen, the national Democrats, are open to the conversation of moving the calendar around. We saw in 2020, the Iowa Democratic caucus was a mess. They were unable to call a victor out of that caucus, which is just a huge, huge screw up, given, you know, the importance and the momentum generated and things, all the different sort of requirements, the millions and millions of dollars spent campaigning in Iowa to do all that. It was a pretty, you know, major screw up. And then the Nevada Democrats, you know, argument is not only that, but, you know, you need to have this, you need to have us go first because we're a diverse state. We look more like the Democratic Party of today versus the Democratic Party of 50 years ago, when a lot of this was sort of, you know, set in motion here, these orders and stuff like that. So, you know, I think that the Democrats are going to be amenable. And so what I'm curious about is what happens if the Democrats say, sure, you're going first. If that's the national party, the DNC comes to an agreement with everybody, all the states, you know, here's what we're going to do. And we're going to change the nominating calendar. And then the Republicans don't. They don't do the same. What exactly happens? And I was wondering, you know, is there going to be a lawsuit or something? And what I've actually heard is that, no, essentially, the Republicans may just end up sort of doing a caucus anyway. They may end up, you know, because caucuses were private organization, you know, they were done privately and funded by the parties, organized by the parties. So I guess there's no sort of law that says they couldn't just do that. I mean, it's essentially just a private meeting with a bunch of people at it. So I guess you could do that.
Well, except for the law that says that the section 5 sub 3 of AB 126 that says that the parties are bound by the results of this primary. Now, if they choose to skip a primary, I mean, and I guess it depends, they would have to coordinate this with the national candidates, because if national candidates come and file and they're on our ballot, and then the Republican voters go to vote and they select those nominees, the delegates have to be bound by our state law by those nominees. The only way that the Republicans could simply have their regular meetings and choose through either a caucus process or a smoke-filled back room process who to bind the delegates to would be if they coordinate with their national candidates, all of their national candidates, and none of them file to be on the ballot here in Nevada, which I think is going to be something. I don't know if the party members want that. I mean, I think the party members, especially the ones that don't want to go to the Republican meetings in Clark County and the state because of, you know, reasons. If you've ever been to one, you know what I'm talking about. I think they would rather go to the voting booth and make their preference known by secret ballot and be done with it. And so it would also dampen, I think, Republican enthusiasm for their candidate, because this early primary allows people to get out, they campaign. We're going to get visits starting in probably at the end of the year, the previous year, from these candidates campaigning. And I don't know that anybody would want to skip that opportunity to raise money, to reach voters, to energize the base, because they would rather the party make the decision in another way when you have this state financed election just sitting there ready to use.
Absolutely. And that is, in fact, what I had essentially heard, is that we being in the scenario being Republicans, we could just skip the primary, not be on the ballot at all, and then hold a meeting, decide in the meeting who gets what delegates, send those meetings to, again, another private event, the Republican National Convention, and do it that way. But you're right. It would take, and I just don't see how, pragmatically, I don't see how there isn't some candidate, particularly a candidate who might be sort of trailing or have a long shot kind of guy who's not necessarily a darling of the Republican National Committee anyway, jumping in and saying, ha, I'm going to take all these Nevada delegates while you guys hold your little meeting and stuff like that. I do think it would be pretty far-fetched. I don't see how both parties don't adjust to this law change as they have to previous law changes. You know, it's not unusual to change, you know, election dates or anything like that. This happened in other states, you know, quite a lot lately. The order hasn't always been what it was and things like that. But I mean, I think the major point in this is that in the next year, both parties are going to have start having national meetings talking about sort of the national calendar and the realities of what a 2024 presidential election look like. And there, then you're going to see some movement. I've heard that, you know, if the DNC does not buy into Nevada's thing, either the other states would move their calendar, or there may, you know, in the next legislative session, they may sort of compel Nevada Democrats to amend this law again and to fix it. It might not be something that is as set in stone as what was signed just last week. It could go any number of ways. And you are right. You made a very good point there early, is that when Nevada goes first, even when Nevada goes third, but particularly if Nevada was to go first, then you're talking about really, I'd say, over a year, because in the last caucus season, the Bernie folks were here, the Elizabeth Warren, Biden, some of those campaigns were here almost about a year before the actual February caucuses. That's right. When I started meeting with their people, their sort of advanced ground teams kind of a thing. And so that's even earlier when you're talking about Iowa. I mean, you know, whoever goes first gets the lion's share of the candidate's time, money, and energy, you know, for very obvious reasons, for a number of reasons. And so there's a lot at stake for the state, really, and for both parties and for the voters in however this does shake out. Because I have noticed, and you have noted, you've been here longer than me, talked to more of them than I have, but I have noticed that Nevada voters, when it comes to presidential, you know, caucus time, now primary time, they do expect to see the candidates. They do expect to be able to see the candidates, to see question and answers, to meet the candidates, to shake their hands, to ask them questions themselves. That is something I have seen. I have seen when there are some candidates who, you know, maybe they spend a little bit more time in Iowa, maybe they spend a little bit more time in New Hampshire or South Carolina, and then they come here. They're here maybe once a month when some other candidates are here four or five times a month. And I've seen voters ask, you know, sort of, I don't want to name, you know, specific names, but I have seen them ask sort of like an Elizabeth Warren or sort of somebody like that. Oh, there we go. I started. You know, where have you been? We wanted to see you. So I do think that there is a lot at stake for parties, not just money and support and, you know, TV cameras and things like that, but for voters themselves to have that experience of vetting. I mean, that's what the assembly speaker said, that Nevadans are an excellent place for a presidential candidate to come and get vetted, to be pressed on various issues, because Nevada is so diverse, so many different types of voters here. People from all over the country move to Nevada for one reason or another. There's a lot of reasons there that it's good for the candidates too, and the voters and everybody. So I think we'll see, you know, how it shakes out. I think it's going to be very interesting.
And there's one other factor too. There's one other factor, and that is this. If the Republicans, and we're talking about the Republicans, not to pick on them, but because it's very likely that the Democrats engineered this, so they're going to go with this plan, and they're going to pursue this, I think. But if the Republicans decide, okay, no, we're not going to have Nevada go first, we're going to have another state go first, we're going to have other states go before Nevada, you know, Iowa, New Hampshire, whatever other state, they move up because they don't like this new procedure that the Democrats have engineered in the state of Nevada, passed through a Democratic legislature with just a few Republican votes. The question then is going to be, you know, what other state do they pick? And if they don't pick a state that has at least as much diversity of population as Nevada, they're going to open themselves up to uncomfortable questions about why that is. Why wouldn't you want Nevada to go first? Right now, Nevada is the most diverse of the first three states, certainly of the first three. No question about that. That's one of the reasons we got jumped to the high position on the calendar that we are at now. And so if the Republicans elect not to go that route, I think you will see people, including Republicans in this state, stand up and say, hey, wait a minute. Why aren't you keeping us in this top rank, even if we don't go through the primary system and we do this other kind of jury-rigged thing along on the side? We should be still allowed to go in that early cycle, early, you know, period, because if we're not, then it raises questions as to why that is. And I don't think the Republicans want those questions. And so I think that's another reason that while they may not like what Nevada has done, I think it's now just to coin a phrase, a historical inevitability that they will have to go along with this procedure. And I think they will go along with it with the primary, because doing the opposite or just going around it takes so much more effort and produces so fewer results and benefits that I just don't think that they'll skip it like some people are saying they might. I think that's a threat, and I don't think that is going to actually happen in the real world. So we'll see. But right now I think there's the bill was just signed and there's some people who are kind of irked about it, and so we'll see if that sense of outrage lasts until the 2024, the first Tuesday in February of 2024, which is slated to be Nevada's very first presidential preference primary.
Yeah, and just one sort of final kind of point on this. I have seen some more sort of pragmatic type Republicans who've basically said, look, this is one of the many things, as well as, they really did not like the Republican Legislative Caucus, so really did not like the other election bill that we mentioned that makes vote by mail permanent and universal. Yeah. Things like that. They really, that one was a complete partisan vote. So one of the things I've seen from some of those members, since then with both the, in terms of like this caucus order and other things, is see, this is what happens when we're in the minority. This is, this is why we need to channel our efforts not on, circumventing the voting ways and getting at the Dems in that way, these types of games basically being played.
It's a great point.
Channel our efforts to getting more Republicans in the legislature, because all we
point.
Can do
great point
is go into 2022 and break the Democratic majority, and we'll change the law and we'll fix this. We won't even have to get there. So there is that argument to be made for Republicans too. And it's obviously quite difficult. There's been a pretty strong majority for a few years now, but not impossible. It's not happened. I mean, in 2014, it seemed like there were, you saw massive Republican gains. There is precedent for flipping the governor's office and the legislature and, the various things like that.
No, you're absolutely right. It has definitely happened. And so that definitely can be a possibility. I think of the late, great Cy Ryan, a longtime Capitol Bureau reporter for the Las Vegas Sun, who always said, always root for the story. So as far as our business goes, I think it's great that that's we a great have one. a very early spot in the calendar, whether it's one or three. I think it's great that we have that. I hope it's one, because that will give us even more attention than we've had in the past, way more than we have any right to expect. We will get presidential visits left, right, and center, and we reporters will get to know the candidates very intimately, I think, over the course of all that. And so, and not to mention the spending that happens. I mean, the hiring of staff, the spending on media, the economic impact of those elections really does have an impact. And you don't have to just own a television station, although it would be helpful if you did, because that's really where the money goes. But there's still a bunch of other stuff, money that is spent here that benefits the community as well. So it's good for Nevada all the way around, I think, to have this early position, and now not to have to go through the Byzantine caucus process and just go to the polls like we're used to doing.
You are absolutely right about that. That was something that struck me during the caucuses, is, these 50, 60 vacant offices that are filled with people that are paying rent, that are all eating at restaurants here. And being first means probably thousands, probably over 1,000 sort of stuff, because we saw hundreds just in our third position this last time. You're talking about a lot of people, a lot of interviews for us to do, which are always good. We got a good amount this last time, but none of those. And then even though it is a completely separate part of the building and I have no contact with them, I'm sure the Review Journal's advertising department would not mind going first either during political advertising season either. So, has no bearing on what my job is, but Yeah, you are right. It is worth noting that as journalists, we also favor going first. There's no getting around that. So
absolutely.
All right. Well, I think we're pretty much out of time for this week. You know, as we've mentioned, a lot of this stuff will be playing out in the weeks and months and years ahead, and we will be right there with it and give you updated, you know, pretty much every Friday, as sort of time and assignments allow. If you like what you hear, you can always subscribe to, you know, wherever you're listening to your podcast. You can find each of us on Twitter at Rory Does Phonics and at Steve Sibelius. For the RJ Politics podcast, I'm politics reporter Rory Appleton.
And I'm politics and government editor Steve Sibelius.
Thanks for listening.
Watch your DVR Nevada Newsmakers Saturday and Sunday mornings from 5:30 to 6:30 on Cox Cable Channel 12 or Dish and DirecTV Channel 21 or anytime at NevadaNewsmakers.com.
I'm Jeff Gehrman, an investigative reporter with the Las Vegas Review-Journal. I'm your guide for Season 2 of Mobbed Up, The Fight for Las Vegas.
You're in with every gangster and hooligan in the United States.
I don't go for that, Mr. Kennedy. I don't go for that kind of action.
I was on television accused of fronting for the mob.
Subscribe to Mobbed Up, The Fight for Las Vegas, Season 2, today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.